Testing.
Okay, now that Terry's here, we can get started. welcome to the second session of the class. Is there anybody new here that I haven't talked to or wasn't here last time? Okay, I'd like to see you afterwards.
That's fine.
So today we're going to start off with some administrative items, and then I'll talk a little bit about student projects, and then we'll have our guest speaker.
Okay.
First of all, I want you to note my new email address. It got changed last week after 25 years, so please make a note of that. And also, Debbie Kenny's email address has changed. Please make a note of it on the suggested projects handout from last week. And we also have an additional resource person that will that can help you with student projects, Jaime Vargas. He's actually the person who developed the skill set and the WIS devices that were mentioned in the project handout. And these additions are on the website. First, I want to talk about the class again. If you're just taking the lectures, you get one credit, but since there's no test, there's going to be no letter grade for just taking the lectures. So if you signed up for a letter grade for one credit, you're going to have to change that on Access. And if you need a grade for the class, you have to sign up for the two credits, which means you have to be working on a project as well. And in that situation, you can take it either credit, no credit, or for a letter grade. But in either case, please make the corrections on Access so it's properly recorded. There are some people that weren't here last week, and you may have a good excuse for missing a lecture, but what we're doing this year is audio recording the lectures and putting all the PowerPoints and handouts on the website. So if you did miss a lecture, I would like you to review the audio and the handouts on the web and write a short one-paragraph summary of your thoughts about the lecture, and that will give you credit for attending the class. Now, this is not an alternative. You know, if you decide, well, I'm not going to go to class, I'm going to listen to the audio, that's not an appropriate excuse. So please be here every day. This is the sign-up sheet. For all the students that are enrolled in the course, it's mandatory that you sign the sheet so I know that you're here. And for people in the community that I don't already have on my list and who haven't gotten an emailed announcement, you can sign up on here. But you only have to do that once because my computer remembers. So I'll pass this around for you. And it's students' responsibility to find where that clipboard is. Okay. Student projects. Last week I passed around the project handouts. And I hope you had a chance to talk with your other classmates and think about which project you like to work on and form a team. And how many people have actually done that, done this? Okay. So what I'd like you to do if you have time after class is to really get that squared away and form a team and pick a project and report, back to me, who is on the team. How many people will be working on a project this quarter? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, 7. Okay, that's good. So, the team should be no more than 3 members. And if you need any additional information, I can be available. Okay. And again, the class website is as listed there, and it was also on your handout. Next week, we're going to have Gary Karp come and talk to us. He'll be driving down from San Rafael. I've heard him talk several times. He's a very inspiring person to listen to. And he'll be talking about life on wheels from the comfort of his own wheelchair. So it'll be a firsthand thing. And any questions so far? Okay.
You know everything.
Oh.
I would ideally each team should be working on a different project.
And we have to decide that way.
As soon as possible. If you can stay afterwards and get that squared away, you know, sort of meet in the corner or something and decide that, that would be great. Okay. If you can guess where that picture was taken, you get an extra point.
Lower left.
Yeah. It's my pleasure to introduce for the second time Molly Story, and she's president of Human Spectrum Design in up north, and the co-director of the Rehab Engineering Research Center on Accessible Medical Instrumentation. She's a PhD student in economics at Ergonomics. Oh, I'm sorry. I read it wrong. At Berkeley. And she's an expert, as you'll find out, in universal design of products and in the accessibility and usability of medical instrumentation. She has authored several books, and she's been around for a while. And she'll be talking about... Well, that just shows her expertise. You know, I've been around a while, too. That just shows my age. But Molly's going to talk about universal design and designing for accessibility, which, as we find out, is larger than, you know, campus-based design and bigger than California, bigger than national or international. It's encompasses the entire universe. So you can't get much bigger than that. And Molly, please enlighten us. You may hand over the microphone.
It doesn't. It doesn't project in here, but it records for you.
It's recorded for me.
Okay. That's too bad. They design these for men. Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah.
I don't have a pocket. All right. Is it possible to make it any darker? The contrast in these is not what it should be, and I apologize. I don't speak that loudly to begin with, and I'm getting over a cold. So please raise your hands in the back if I fade out on you.
What do I want to say?
Most of what I'm going to present today is based on the work that I did at the Rehab Engineering Research Center on Universal Design in the Built Environment at North Carolina State, and also the Rehab Engineering Research Center on Accessible Medical Instrumentation. The funding for both of these projects is provided by the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research, which is part of the U.S. Department of Education. So this is your tax dollars to good use. I'm going to talk about three things, a little bit about my professional life, because Dave asked us to do that, quite a bit about universal design, and then at the end I'd like to talk a little bit about accessible medical instrumentation and some of the things that we've learned. I shortened the universal design section this year and added some videos at the end because I want to show you some of the things we're seeing in the real world. We did a survey where we asked people about things. We did some focus groups where they told us some more detail. But when you see it in real life, when you videotape people using things in the real world, it is much more striking, much more problematic than people told us. I think partly because people with disabilities live with difficulties all of their daily lives. I think that they assume a certain amount of difficulty. But I want to show you some of the things that people are experiencing when they use standard medical equipment. So I got a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from Princeton. I graduated in 1978, worked for a couple years in San Francisco as a structural engineer for a company called GFDS Engineers. There were six partners and two other engineers. including myself. I was the first woman they ever hired permanently. This was the first obstacle in my career. I worked there for 2 years, and they never once took me to a job site. I think because I was young and female, and they were afraid of how I and the construction workers and I would get along. So I went back to graduate school and got a master's degree in product design from Stanford. Came out of there and was recruited to join Raychem Corporation, which was in Menlo Park. They were bought by Tyco, but they recruited me to do product invention. And so in my 6 months in Menlo Park, I actually generated a couple of different patent applications that turned into 3 patents. That's enough for now. I then got married, moved to Atlanta, became self-employed, working as a consultant to Raychem again. Over the next couple of years, a few more patent applications, a few more patents. I worked for them also in Raleigh, North Carolina. They actually flew me up there every week for a year and a half to do some product development up there. So I would teach at Georgia Tech on Mondays and Fridays and work in North Carolina Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. It was pretty stressful. In 1988, I had a child. She's in the back of the room. My daughter Hannah is now 19, almost 20, sophomore at Cornell. So I was teaching in Georgia. Then my husband got transferred to North Carolina. Should have joined Raychem, but they wouldn't hire someone who was married to someone who worked there, which didn't make any sense because I already had been working there for 3 years and had my own track record, my own patents. But anyway, doesn't matter. I looked around for something better, discovered that somebody who had just taken over the industrial design department at North Carolina State was somebody I had taught with at Georgia Tech. And he needed somebody to teach sophomore studio. So I taught industrial design studio at North Carolina State. And the first day of classes, the guy who was director of the Center for Universal Design came in looking for students to work on 2 projects. One was a series of product evaluations where they were bringing standard everyday products to the table, bringing in people with various disabilities, and just asking them what they thought of these different things. And then we were writing that up in some buyer's guides. We were also doing a ramp study of different ramp slopes for the access board to find out what was the optimal ramp, because they had come out with this law of 1 to 20 being the minimum ramp and 1 to 12 being the steepest allowable and 30 feet being the maximum length, but no one had ever confirmed it. One of the interesting things about that is when we looked at people who use ramps, we had to come up with a population for that. And so we decided we'd study people who use walking aids as some approximation of who needs a ramp, or mobility aids of all different types. And we discovered that 60% or something, 2/3 of the people who use walking aids were over the age of 65 and they had never been tested. So we made sure to test them on a ramp with their aids and wheelchair users. The only group we weren't able to test is people who push other people in wheelchairs, because there's no way to get your hands on that data. So we didn't test that group. But anyway, I jumped on board. I said, I'm really interested in what you're doing. And the rest is history. Oh, then, let's see. Let me go back one. In, what year was it? It must have been 1996. My husband was relocated again to Denver. So I continued to work for the Center for Universal Design in North Carolina from Denver. I also taught 2 semesters, a course over the Internet on universal design, which was fascinating because I had students all over the country and a couple of them in Japan. So I'd have them send me pictures and describe things, and it was really very fun. But then in, what year? It must have been, it was 2002. We moved to California. Back to California, finally, back to Santa Rosa. Just as we were moving our household, the RFP came out for the RERC and accessible medical instrumentation. And I said, if anything is universal design, it's medical equipment. I really want to take part in this. And a mutual colleague put a team together, and we've been working on it ever since. And I do a little consulting on the side. So that's my crooked pathway. But I wanted to talk a little bit about teaching industrial design and my great frustration at doing this, especially initially, where the sophomores, particularly, I guess they were new at this, maybe all students are guilty of it, were designing mostly for themselves. And I found that very frustrating no matter what I did to try to talk them out of it. They decided if it was good for me, it was good for everybody else. So I said, okay, I'm going to make you design for anybody but yourself. So I have them designing for preschoolers, and I have them designing for elders, and I have them designing for homeless people and people with disabilities. But I made them go out and meet these people and experience their lives, come back, write a report, make some stuff, and then I brought those people back in to critique those designs. And that was a completely different experience for them. Completely opened their eyes that maybe they didn't know everything, maybe just because it was good for them or they thought it was good for them, maybe they didn't know as much as they thought they did. So this was much more fun for me, and this was what I discovered while I was still in Georgia. So when I got to North Carolina and discovered the Center for Universal Design, everything sort of fell into place for me. This is a photograph of Ron Mace, the late. He was a polio survivor, one of the pioneers in the movement of accessibility in the United States, helped write some of the first accessibility laws. He attended North Carolina State, got his architecture degree because his mother was willing to carry him up the stairs to class. He was the director of the Center for Universal Design when I got there, and I had the great pleasure of working with Ron for the last 4.5 years of his life. So it was a wonderful thing. His definition of universal design is that it's the design of all products and environments to be usable by people of all ages and abilities to the greatest extent possible. This is not special equipment for special people. This is access in everything as far as we can push it. And this, to me, was a big light bulb. You don't have to design for the individual groups. It is possible to do it all at the same time. So when I got to North Carolina State and learned about universal design, I began to teach that. And again, giving them projects that had some emphasis for a specific disability group, but which had to be used by everyone in the household, everyone in the community, whatever it was, these are things where access needs to be simply there from the beginning. So I did things like a height-adjustable toilet, primarily for people with mobility disabilities, an auxiliary captioning device for battery-powered TVs. I discovered that, yes, captioning is required on any TV that is 13 inches and larger, but not on anything smaller than that. And if the power goes out, your TV is going to be smaller than that. Battery-powered TVs don't have captions. So I thought that was kind of an interesting aftermarket product. Can we put a captioning device with a battery-powered TV? So if you can't hear, you can get the messages too. A can opener for one-handed users? I challenge you on that one. Go home and open a can of anything with one hand. Not many can openers can, but anyway. The telephone answering machine and caller ID all in a single device for someone with a vision impairment, that's come along. And a simple programmable home thermostat for someone with a cognitive disability, but wouldn't we all like it to be a little simpler? Again, this is a technology that has advanced since I've assigned this. So, but I want to make the critical difference between accessible design and universal design, where accessible design is designed strictly or primarily for people with disabilities. Universal design is for everyone at the same time, including people with disabilities. It's a different sensibility. And the critical difference between the two is integrating accessible features in there so they look like they belong, not so that it looks like you designed your beautiful object and at the last minute you tried to glue something on the outside, like so many ramps look like on so many buildings, and other accessibility features where they've ripped out two stalls to put one in or whatever it is. When you design it in from the beginning, it is a design challenge and it is doable. So I want to challenge some of these things. Some of the devices you have around you could be considered to be accessible or they could be considered to be universal depending on your perspective. Something like a magnifying glass is accessible if you use it to read, but it's universal if you're plucking an eyebrow or removing a splinter or something else. Television headphones are really nice if you're hard of hearing and you want to crank it up for yourself without having everyone else disturbed by it. But it's also really nice if the person in bed next to you wants to go to sleep and you want to stay up and listen to the TV or whatever else, or work. Vibrating pager is something, or a vibrating telephone. The vibrating pager was actually designed for people with hearing impairments, but again, it's handy for all kinds of things. When you're in a noisy location or a quiet library, someplace where it's supposed to be quiet, or a meeting. Big grip utensils. The one on the left is from the catalogs, these aftermarket foam cylinders you can add to onto the end of something. But ever since Sam Farber came out with OXO Good Grips, suddenly it's mainstream. Now we've all got big grips. It's not just for his wife with arthritis. The electric cart is one of my favorites. Is this a piece of assistive technology? Or is this a piece of recreational gear? Depends on your perspective, depends on your application. It's all pretty much the same part of the spectrum, isn't it? So, I want to challenge this notion of designing for the middle 90% of the population. We talk about human factors and how all these human abilities fall into this bell curve from low to high, and 90% of your observations are in the middle, and so we're supposed to cut off the ends of the bell curve and design for the middle 90, right? Well, if you design for 95% by visual acuity, and then 95% by hearing ability, and then 95% by cognitive ability, and you carry that on out, pretty soon you don't have a very big market group. Your target group shrinks in a big hurry. So I challenge you on that notion. Make sure you push those limits as far as you can every time. Besides, people on the one end of one bell curve can be at the other end of the other bell curve. My favorite examples are people with hearing disabilities tend to be really observant. They tend to be really aware of their surroundings. If you've ever driven with someone who's deaf, they really look around. People with vision disabilities tend to be really good listeners. I remember picking up a phone and talking to a colleague who'd moved to Hawaii, and we were chatting, and he said, "You're not in the South anymore, are you?" And I said, "How can you tell?" And he said, "The accent's gone." Well, I grew up in California. I never knew I had an accent, but apparently I picked it up and dropped it again. But this will be in the handout. When I give Dave the slides, you can look this up. It's really a wonderful example of Introduction to the Screen Reader with Neil Ewers. This is done by the Trace Center at University of Wisconsin at Madison. And he's a speed listener. He listens to tapes and audio so much, and he's not the only one. Some people with vision loss become speed listeners. And you can listen to this sample of a screen reader talking to him, and it is completely unintelligible to me, but apparently he can understand it perfectly. It's really a wonderful thing. So you have to watch those bell curves. Sometimes they can flip on you. So, I want to introduce you to the principles of universal design. It was one of the things I was in the right place at the right time for, was at the Center for Universal Design, and particularly Mike Jones, who was the director then, had written into a proposal that we were going to write up the principles of universal design. The basic concepts of universal design needed to be articulated, because before this it had only been taught through example. And examples are still good, but we needed to somehow define the universe of what is universal design. So most of the people in this room, a couple were present only by telephone, but we spent a couple days in a room together, pulling together everything we knew about universal design, all of the different rules and guidelines that we'd heard or were repeated or made up or whatever, all of the things that we thought comprised universal design, and wrote it all over the walls, and then we spent the next couple of years organizing this. And this is quite a group. I don't want to take the time to go through it, but they're all over. At the time, we were mostly all at the Center for Universal Design. Now we've all split up. But the seven principles of universal design, and there is a handout, so you don't have to write this down, are equitable use, flexibility in use, simple and intuitive use, perceptible information, tolerance for error, low physical effort, and size and space for approach and use. And I'll go through these one at a time. First is equitable use. The design is useful and marketable to people with diverse abilities. In other words, design for all. Design for everyone at the same time as far as you possibly can. There are four guidelines. First, provide the same means of use for all users. And second, avoid segregating or stigmatizing any users. This is a nice example of a weight scale in a healthcare facility that is recessed in the floor, so there's no threshold to trip over. There's it's large enough to accommodate some wheelchairs, not all. And it has a readout on the wall, so everybody can use the same scale. The third guideline is to make privacy, security, and safety equally available to all users and make the design appealing to all users. The image shows a water park for children, but you'll notice that some users are standing, some are sitting, some are in the water. You can roll up alongside it and still play in the water even though you're seated or short. Second is flexibility in use. The design accommodates a wide range of individual preferences and abilities. In other words, design for each person as far as you can. So when possible, building in flexibility allows things to be a little more customizable as you go. First, provide choice in methods of use. This could mean any number of different things depending on what it is you're designing. And accommodate right or left-handed access, or foot, or side, whatever it is, needs to be usable from, by either side. The example is a height-adjustable examination table, which is easier for the patient to get on and off, but it's also good for healthcare professionals who are different heights and who are performing different procedures on that table, and they can raise the table to or lower to whatever height they need as well. Third is facilitate the user's accuracy and precision. And fourth, provide adaptability to the user's pace. The image shows the speed control on a dictation machine. Again, this whole concept of speed listening. You can also slow something down if it's not clear to you, if you're trying to hear something, or you can speed it up if you want to hear it more quickly. Third, simple and intuitive use. Use of the design is easy to understand regardless of the user's experience, knowledge, language skills, or current concentration level. This is not just about ability, it's about situation also. In other words, design for the mind. This is about the cognitive side of the design. First guideline is eliminate unnecessary complexity. A lot of the bells and whistles don't always have to be there. Second, be consistent with user expectations and intuition. The example shows a seat control in an automobile where the seat control is shaped like the seat. The seat back is mostly vertical, slanted slightly backward. You can push it forward and back. The seat bottom is horizontal. You can move it forward and back. You can move the front or the back up or down. And the control tells you that without very much too many graphics. Third, accommodate a wide range of literacy and language skills. This has to do with literacy and language of origin, which is a huge complication, a very difficult challenge for universal design, especially when you get to icons and things like that. This is still very difficult no matter what. And fourth, arrange information consistent with its importance. The image shows a telephone with fire, police, and ambulance, I guess, across the top in brightly colored buttons. And they're also, they're not tactically different. They should be more tactically different than they are. But they're right up on top so that if you're looking for help, you can get it in a hurry. And the fifth guideline for Principle 3 is to provide effective prompting and feedback during and after task completion. The example shows an automatic defibrillator that rather than having pads that you have to place somehow, they're connected to one another, so you can at least get them close. And the device talks you through each step. It lights up and talks in sequence, talking you through the whole process of defibrillating someone who's having a heart attack. Principle 4 is perceptible information. The design communicates necessary information effectively to the user, regardless of ambient conditions or the user's sensory ability. This has to do with designing for the senses, primarily vision and hearing. First guideline, use different modes for redundant presentation of essential information. Second, maximize the legibility of the essential information in all sensory modes so that the signal needs to stand out from the background, that kind of thing. In this case, this is screenshots. It's a little hard to see, I know, of the fare machine at the Metro in Washington, D.C., where it provides information in high contrast, upper and lowercase white on a dark background. It also has raised all uppercase letters because those are easier to feel with the fingers. The upper and lowercase is easier to read with the eyes. Below the raised all caps is Braille. And then if you see to the far right, there's a button that says push for audio. It will also talk to you. So that's, what, four different ways that you can get the information from the machine. It's a pretty nice example. Third guideline, differentiate elements in ways that can be described. In other words, make it easy to give directions. This was suggested by a graphic designer who was working with us who's very frustrated at not being able to describe things. Fourth guideline, provide compatibility with a variety of techniques or devices that are used by people, meaning all types of assistive technologies. If people use a hearing aid, it needs to be T-coil compatible, headphones, Braille, captioning, that sort of thing. The example shows the backs of a couple of different computers. Again, old slide, I need to update it. But the point is that the cables are different sizes and shapes, which makes it much harder to plug the wrong thing in the wrong place, and also color-coded. Principle 5 is tolerance for error. The design minimizes hazards and the adverse consequences of accidental or unintended actions. In other words, design for error because people will make mistakes. First guideline, arrange elements to minimize hazards and errors. Keep the dangerous things out of people's way as far as you can. Provide warnings of hazards and errors. The example shows a red stop, green go, but there's a cowl around the start button so that if you were to accidentally run into the machine, you wouldn't accidentally hit the start button. You've got to actually depress the button within that cowling to activate the machine. Third is to provide fail-safe features. If somebody makes a mistake, you don't want them to screw up if you can. Discourage unconscious actions and tasks that require vigilance. This is the dead man switch on a lawnmower. You've got to hold those two things together in order for the blade to engage. Otherwise, if you let go, the blade will stop spinning. Principle 6 is low physical effort. The design can be used efficiently and comfortably with a minimum of fatigue. In other words, designed for limited strength and stamina. First guideline, allow the user to maintain a neutral body position and to use second, to use reasonable operating forces. The example is a split keyboard where someone can keep a neutral wrist angle from the tips of their fingers out to their elbows rather than twisting the wrist. Third, minimize repetitive actions. And fourth, minimize sustained physical effort. These rolling suitcases are such a breakthrough, not only for people with limited strength and stamina, but all the rest of us. And finally, the last principle is size and space for approach and use. Appropriate size and space are provided for approach, reach, manipulation, and use, regardless of the user's body size, posture, or mobility. In other words, designed for different sizes of bodies. First guideline, provide a clear line of sight to important elements for any seated or standing user. Second, make reach to components comfortable for any seated or standing user. The slide shows a nurse's station in a hospital where the patient is very short, but she can still carry on a conversation with the nurse behind the desk at eye level. Third guideline, accommodate variations in hand and grip size. And fourth, provide adequate space for the use of assistive devices or personal assistants. It's really a nice trend to see the family restrooms where you can go in with an assistant or a family member, or you can have small children or whatever it is. You don't have to cram yourself into a small space. And particularly if the person with you is of a different gender, it's particularly nice to be able to do that. Neither one of you has to go in the wrong restroom, as it were. So coming back to the normal distribution, I just want to encourage you to push those limits, question those limits. Are those limits really necessary, or can you go beyond them? I throw this in. It was in Ergonomics and Design in winter 2005. I can read that. By Hancock, wrote an article that I found really useful for me in trying to grapple with the difference between accessibility and usability and universal design and how those all fit together. It shows a pyramid with five levels. The bottom level of the pyramid is safety. Above all, whatever it is we design has to be safe. The second level of the pyramid is functionality. It has to do what it came to do. It has to be usable for the purpose for which it was designed. Above that is usability. Is it efficient? Is it easy? Is it smooth? And then above that is pleasure. Is it a pleasure to use? Is it fun to use? And then above that is individuation, which is way over my head. I'm not even going to go there. But what I realized is that in the context of my work, our work, functionality really equates to accessibility. If it functions in the way, if I can use it some way, somehow, it's accessible. It may not be very usable, but it's accessible if it's functional for me. So that I thought was an interesting construct. And to me, universal design is where those two come together, where it's both accessible and usable at the same time. Universal design really falls in that overlap between the two. So I put to you that universal design is never going to suit everybody in all situations, but it can benefit most users. It may cost little or nothing additional. It can reduce the need for some assistive technologies, not all, and it can increase social inclusion and participation. It can also increase the market for your assistive technologies. So as you are designing these devices, think about how universal you can make it, because if it is more universal, it may have a larger market, it may have a greater chance of success on the marketplace. So very quickly, I know we're running out of time. I wanted to show you a little bit about what we've learned about medical equipment in the last 5 years. This was a study we did of radiology equipment where we brought, we looked at an X-ray table, a CT scan machine, and a fluoroscopy machine. The subjects were 20 people who used walking aids who were able to walk at least 10 feet, but no more than a quarter mile without having to stop to rest. So I want to show you three short videos. And I hope these show up okay. The first is a woman lying down on an X-ray table. There, we use the standard equipment. We use the people who work in these facilities day in and day out. And these are 20 people who use walking aids. Nothing special. They volunteered. She's in her late 60s. She has survived a stroke. She has partial paralysis on her left side. She has arthritis, chronic pain in her knees, and she uses a walker. She moves very, very slowly. So the technologist is helping her to lie down. She puts one leg up. She's having a hard time keeping it up there. The woman lies her down, and her head goes right off the side of the table. Finally, shifts her around. Notice the pad under her is sliding around. She can't grasp the edge. And one of the interesting things about this study is after each trial, we showed the video to the subject and we asked them to narrate it. I wasn't in the room when the videos were taken, so right afterwards, my students would walk the person over to me in a small conference room with their CD, and I'd put it in my computer and play it for them and ask them to tell me what happened because I wasn't there. And this is all she had to say. And then she helped me stretch out. It wasn't that hard. What does that tell you?
Well,
expectations used to failure. Anything else? And maybe it means she's just not very good at describing her situation. But yeah, maybe in the context of her own life, that's not bad. She may be somebody who falls a lot, and falling and lying down with her head off the side happens all the time. But I think it's really important for us as researchers to understand that. So here's the second one. Sitting down on an x-ray table. Sitting up on an x-ray table. This gentleman is in his 50s. He has cerebral palsy, some paralysis, some weakness on the right side. He has arthritis in his hands and some chronic pain, and he uses a cane. So here he is sitting up. Same x-ray table, same technologist. She reaches over to help him. He wants to sit up with his legs off the side. For some reason, she wants him to lie back on his back. I don't know why. So she pushes him, and he says, okay, I'll sit up. And he's reaching back, and there's nothing under his left hip. His left hip is actually off the side of the table. And he finally sits up with his pad sliding all over the place. So this is what he had to say. The table was fine getting on and off because it was lower. The problem I had was the mat that was underneath me was kind of slippery. Of course, I'm a little heavier. Someone lighter might not be as much of a problem. But turning because of that mat on the slippery metal surface made it a little tougher to try to turn and keep that mat underneath me. The width of the platform, you have to be careful. In turning, you don't have much width to maneuver with because of the machine. And that has to be considered, especially if you're sliding on the platform. What do you think? I think it's really sad that he's blaming himself for the problems with the equipment. But, yeah, really slippery. Why isn't that mat secured to that surface? I mean, it's bad enough to try to sit up on that thing when your balance is not great, but when the pad isn't even stable, we got some problems. And then finally, this one's kind of dark, and I hope you can see it. I'll describe it as well as I can. This woman's in her 50s. She has cerebral palsy. She has a history of herniated disc in the lumbar region, some paralysis, some arthritis, chronic pain. She uses two canes to walk. And her feet do not come together. Her knees come together, but her feet splay out from the knees. So in trying to get this woman onto the fluoroscopy table, which is very high, there is a pull-out step, but it doesn't come out very far, and it's not very large. So the technologist had the wisdom to give her an auxiliary step, one of those ones you've probably seen with a handlebar on one side, so that she at least had a larger area to stand on while she was trying to get up on the fluoroscopy table. Where's my cursor? So here we go. So she's got her hand on the handle. Her canes are resting on the edge of the platform. There she goes. She's putting her canes down. Technologist hangs them on the side of the platform. She gets on. She's struggling to turn around. The technologist has her hand on her hip in a place that's very inconvenient for the woman, but somehow she turns around with not very much space. She's holding onto the footboard. She's finally turned around. Now, she puts both hands on the platform and jumps onto the table. The canes fall on the ground. The technologist has her hand on her knee. She finally makes it up, jumping from these two steps onto the table. You see, I'm having a lot of difficulty getting on that little extended piece that pulls out because it's not big enough, it's not wide enough, and it doesn't extend far enough. And actually, I just need a bigger and wider surface that I can grab on and hold on and turn myself around and push with all my weight on my arms. And she's trying to help me by holding my legs, which is keeping me from doing it. So I told her to put her hands down so that I could use my arms to get up there. Amazing. Go ahead.
The technician isn't very helpful.
No.
In all these examples.
Surprisingly. And one of the things is we came up with a system of identifying the obstacles to use that were in the equipment. And we came up with one that was an external barrier. And originally it was an environmental barrier because we figured there would be a table in the way or something. And then we had to make it simply external and include human obstacles because it turns out that the technicians can go either way. It was really fascinating. Either the technologist is getting in the way and making okay equipment worse or bad equipment worse, or they're making up for the equipment. In some cases, they served as the missing armrest, the missing guardrail, and stood on the far side of the x-ray table so that guy didn't fall off the far side. So the technologist is a big piece of this whole dynamic. They can make it better or worse. That became very clear. So anyway, this is my contact information. I think it's also on the thing you received, and it'll be on the PowerPoint. But Eric.
I'm spending a lot of time these days with Parkinson's patients, putting them on and off CT and MRI tables.
Uh-huh.
The CT tables we have are lower.
Yep.
So that eliminates at least some part of the problem. But there's a fixed pad, and then there's a sheet on top of the pad. Right. The sheet is going to be slippery because it has to satisfy conflicting demands. It has to be stable when they get onto it, but then you have to slide them back and forth on the table position properly. So it has to be both high friction and low friction at the same time, and you can't do both.
Well, the interesting thing about the x-ray table and the slippery pad is that we watched the technologist position the patient because we were simulating something on each of these, and this was a knee x-ray, so they would use the pad to move the patient. But this table moves up, down, back, forward, any way, which way you want. They're not using the controls, they're using the pad because it's easier for them. That's unconscionable. And one of the things I'm doing for my PhD work is to study the height of the table to figure out how high should it be, because we're now all advocating chair height for the table, which is fine if you're transferring from a wheelchair that's slightly higher. But if you don't have good thigh strength, that chair is probably too low for you. So I'm expecting the result that we will want a higher table height than the chair height, but lower than the current exam table height. So there's something in between, and we need to do the research to have the recommendation. The ideal is adjustable, but I know we're not going to replace all tables in the world anytime soon. So what can we do for the tables that aren't adjustable or some of these x-ray platforms? You know, is radiology going to be height adjustable anytime soon? Maybe. Ideally, but not necessarily, and I'm not going to wait. So we're doing some research now to figure out what the recommendations should be. But I love this work. And again, if anything's going to be universal, it's medical equipment. We're not going to have the accessible MRI machine and the regular MRI machine. We're going to have one. So part of the fun for me is being able to practice universal design without having to describe it. I simply call it accessible, and universal is the only way to make it happen. Anything else? Dave.
How do you inject yourself into the design process for, or how would, you know, a universal designer inject themselves into the design process for something like an MRI machine?
The hospital gets sued for lack of access. That gets a lot of attention, unfortunately. I mean, that's the way a lot of this is happening. There's actually a bill pending. Tom Harkins introduced a bill to Congress to mandate accessible tables. I think all that's in it now is tables. Originally, it all said weight scales. But I think right now, all of this is a table. But if you can't even get on the exam table, and a lot of people can't, what kind of health care are you going to get? How is your health care compromised by not being able to get on a table and get a full exam? Many people are getting exams and procedures done in the wheelchair, and they're concerned about second quality care, and I think second-class care, and I think that's legitimate.
Is there any way to, more positive way to do this other than litigation or legislation?
Well, yeah, we're trying to hit several things. In the RERC, we're coming out with a number of different guidelines for making this kind of equipment accessible. We're also members of the Human Factors Committee of the Association for the Advancement of Medical Instrumentation, which has produced a standard on human factors design for medical equipment, and we had the opportunity to write the section on accessibility. So we're writing that kind of guidance into the human factors design guidance for medical equipment. We think it will have an effect long term because it's not just the patient side. This is also healthcare providers who are aging. Maybe they're injured. But I bet, you know, as they age, their eyesight is not as what it used to be. That small print is not so easy to read. They can't hear quite so well. Alarms are a big problem for everyone. How do you distinguish in the emergency room all those different alarm signals? There are lots of different reasons for practicing good human factors design, and this all fits neatly with that, especially if you look at diversity of users. It's all kind of coming together. So we're trying to work on the promotional end as well as the stick end. Yes? For the 2.5%? Well, first of all, I disagree with it being 2.5%. I think many more people will benefit from these changes than those 2.5. It's just those are the ones who are completely excluded right now. So one of the things we're trying to tie this type of work to is safety. Patient safety is a huge issue. It's a huge hot button, and it's a place we get to push because this has everything to do with patient safety. I couldn't get anybody to let me into the hospital to do this work until I found the patient safety person. And she said, come on in, where do you want to go? Because she understood immediately, this is a patient safety issue. I mean, it's a safety on any number of levels. It's also, you know, efficiency of care. It's bad for the healthcare system also if people aren't getting the care they need. So it is an additional cost, but if you compare the cost of a height-adjustable table to the cost of the person who falls off it, maybe it doesn't look so bad anymore. You know, it depends on how you want to look at this cost and what kinds of equipment you're looking at. You know, if it's a weight scale and you're going to buy another one next year anyway, maybe it's not such a big deal. If you're talking about the MRI machine and the gentleman who weighs 800 pounds, it's a huge deal. But we heard stories of people having to go to Marine World to get MRIs also. So it's a reality. Yes? Absolutely. The industry's getting better. They really are. I think there's less and less of the design for myself mentality. Human factors in general is getting more attention. Usability, I think they're always industry leaders. You know, like companies like Apple with the Apple computer and the iPhone and all of that, with their usability stuff sort of set a standard. And when they succeed, the ripple effect is really nice. We don't have that in all industries, but in medical equipment, error-free, safe are really big ones. You were talking about the design for yourself. I think it's getting better. I think people are becoming more aware, and more of the schools are teaching human factors and the human side of this, which they have to. But they never push universal as much as I want. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Molly.